You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is... World Anvil is a browser-based world-building platform designed for all world builders, writers and novelists, dungeon masters, game developers, and everyone else. World Anvil keeps your world settings safe and organized, helps you find your characters, locations, plots, timelines, and maps quickly and easily as you write. Then, if you choose, you can showcase your amazing world building to the world, beautifully and interactively, to keep your readers engaged. You can even use our professional tier to build your career, selling access to behind-the-scenes content your readers will love, and growing your community. Build your world setting in any genre with over 25 custom-built world-building templates, complete with prompts to inspire your creativity. Allow your readers to explore the public parts of your world in an innovative new way with interactive maps, timelines, and wiki-style articles. Give special access to co-authors, beta readers, customers, or patrons to see exclusive behind-the-scenes content. There's a free version to get started with all of the major features. Guild membership offers you a host of extra options, including comprehensive privacy settings, co-authors, presentation options, and so much more. Join our community of over 800,000 world builders, including professional authors. Take part in competitions and learn more about world building at this fantastic online community. Use the coupon code HANK to get 20% off all 6 and 12 month subscriptions. WorldAnvil.com. I'm a recent convert and I know you will be too. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have Andrea Bartz on the show with me today. She has a phenomenal new thriller. It's called The Herd. And let me tell you what, this is a book that you need to have on your summer reading list. And welcome to the show, Andrea.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. Andrea, we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
What's interesting is that in college, I was a journalism major and I discovered magazines. I had internships. I fell in love with it. And that was all I wanted to do with my life. I wanted to work in magazines. I wanted to work my way up to an editor-in-chief. And about 5 years ago, I left the industry because magazines kept folding and disappearing around me, and got into fiction. And I recently found a diary from when I was little, and it had a little questionnaire at the beginning, like, you know, best friend, favorite song, all those kinds of things, favorite color. And it said basically what I want to be when I grow up. And I wrote author. And so it's funny because in the ensuing years, I kind of forgot that that was what I had really wanted to do as a little kid. I loved reading. I had a big typewriter in my room and was always working on stories and making little books. So it was something I did in the midst of, you know, all the other playing as a little kid. And it was just always sort of a joy of mine making books and stories and poems. And yeah, I don't even have one earliest memory, more so a pattern of it, an impression of it from being a kid.
I love that so much. I love the picture of a kid who is just about making books, and
yes,
that's amazing. What were some of your favorite things to read when you were younger?
So I pretty quickly got into the dark side of things, which I suppose now makes sense now that I'm a thriller writer. But I loved, you know, Goosebumps and then Fear Street and Christopher Pike and scary stories to tell in the dark. But I also read, you know, the all sorts of series, because then you could really get into them. So Sweet Valley Twins and Sweet Valley High and Boxcar Children and Babysitter's Club and Babysitter's Little Sister. And just I loved getting into books that I could, you know, start one and then go to the library and fill a tote bag with the next gazillion of them. And in addition to that, some favorites were certainly the Chronicles of Narnia, that whole series. And I really loved the His Dark Materials series, the Golden Compass and so on. And I really liked a trilogy that was called the Tripod Trilogy, which was kind of sci-fi and criminally underrated, in my opinion.
Andrea, what was it about magazines that enticed you so much? What was it about that drew you and made you, you know, want to pursue that for quite a while?
Magazines had a lot of the elements that it combined a lot of things that I loved. So there's storytelling, obviously, but it's storytelling that's in a very collaborative way. And I'm a people person. I'm an extrovert. I love working with teams and I love working with people who have specialties other than mine. So to sit in art meetings and work, you know, with art people who understand stuff I don't, and to be an editor and to have these ideas, but then send a writer into the world to go report on them and kind of shape them together. And eventually to manage people was a lot of fun. And then in addition, I worked in women's magazines. And I started interning. I went when I was in college. It was right before the recession. And so I got to see sort of the last gasp of the glamorous life of a women's magazine editor when, you know, the editor-in-chief had a town car and a clothing budget and all this incredible stuff that I'm pretty sure doesn't exist anymore. So it was also just a lot of fun. It was honestly not that different from the movies. And so it was really great while it lasted throughout my 20s. But yeah, now I'm doing something related but different.
My middle daughter, who just graduated from art school, her favorite movie the whole time growing up has been 13 going on 30. And I don't know if you're familiar with that movie with Jennifer Garner. But
yes.
She, you know, she wanted, her lifelong goal was to be the editor of Poise magazine. And and that has, I mean, my daughter, she has, you know, stuff all over her, you know, walls and stuff. And she, you know, her lifelong dream was to be like an art director at a magazine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that reality is very different now. You know, and she's doing other things, but I think that's hilarious because I've raised that kind of daughter who, you know, that has been her lifelong dream and goal. That's and so then, funny.
And then you had to break it to her that Poise magazine doesn't exist. It's fictional.
Yeah. She figured that out along the way, but
I'm sure.
So, Andrea, all of the time that you were working in magazines, before you came back to writing fiction and had that realization, did you toy with that or flirt with that at all? Was fiction writing in your universe at all?
I didn't start the very first, you know, fiction project that I undertook did end up being The Lost Night. So I wasn't really doing short stories or much creative writing before that, but I had friends who were publishing books, and I asked them a lot of questions, and so it started to feel like a sort of attainable goal. And I started writing The Lost Night when I was still working in magazines, and I just needed something. I needed a writing project that couldn't be taken away from me. I needed something that was mine, because the magazines that I worked at kept sort of collapsing beneath me. As I said, I worked at Glamour, Self, Martha Stewart's Whole Living, Fit Pregnancy, and Natural Health, and none of those exist in their print form anymore, just a few short years later.
That is insane, by the way. Yeah. The change in the media landscape over the last decade is insane. None of those things exist in print anymore. It's hard to imagine a world where that's the truth, but it is. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to see Glamour fall and after so many decades, and Self magazine, my first job, which were once sort of stalwarts of Condé Nast. So I needed something that was going to be mine and that, you know, the people who control the purse strings couldn't take away from me. And so I started working on the manuscript way back in 2014. But then once I started to get into it, it was like, oh, maybe this could become a thing that, you know, I could sell. And at the time I was thinking it might be a side hustle, but then it sort of flipped at a certain point and became my primary gig.
So what was the Lost Night? That was the first book that was published, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Was that your first novel that you had written?
Yes, it was. A lot of authors have kind of a manuscript in the drawer, yeah. But I guess I got lucky because The Lost Night was my first manuscript and it did get published. But I should say the very first version of it is definitely in a drawer and very different from what ended up being published several years later. So it went through a massive number of revisions before it came into its own in book form.
Well, you know, I've known several people that have published their first novel, like you with The Lost Night. And, you know, a lot of people think that when they hear that they published it in the original form. And like you alluded to, that's not always the truth. It goes through lots and lots of revisions most of the time. What was that first idea that you had for The Lost Night? How did that story first come into being for you?
Sure. So I was looking back on my own post-grad years in Brooklyn, in New York City, and I graduated in 2008. So as I alluded to, I graduated right in the thick of the recession, and it was kind of a horrible time for the world at large, but for a certain kind of, you know, privileged young person living in New York City or living in a major city, it was also freeing in a way, because, you know, there were no jobs to be had anyway, and we didn't have that many responsibilities because we had crummy apartments and, you know, no children or dependents. And so for a lot of creative young people, it was this time of just massive creation, just unbridled creation. And everyone was a photographer and everyone had zines and blogs and bands. And it was sort of the, you know, the rise of the hipster.
Yeah.
Out of the recession. And so I was looking back on my own, you know, I was certainly partying a lot in that scene when I was 23 myself. And so I was just thinking about those big warehouse parties in sort of the crummy artist lofts where every door would be open and you could wander from one loft to another and find, you know, a jam session and a poetry reading and an EDM dance party and just all sorts of choose your own adventure things happening on any given Friday night. And I thought, what if after one of those Friday nights, a tenant was found dead in one of the lofts. And so that was the idea that eventually turned into The Lost Night. The entire idea just came from that question of what if there was a dead body in sort of the warehouse party scene of hipster Brooklyn.
I love those kinds of what if scenarios that just mm-hmm. it begins with a simple question and then just won't leave you alone. I've had several like that, you know, for days you just walk around and this niggling question just won't leave you. How long was it before a character showed up in that situation?
Well, I sort of identified the dead body pretty quickly and figured out that I wanted it to be a woman, a young woman. I wanted her to be sort of the ringleader of a clique that lived there and was very sort of involved in the scene. And so that was where I came up with Edie, the young woman. And the next question was, okay, is this a police investigation? Is this, you know, how does this play out as sort of a whodunit? And I decided to set this mystery 10 years ahead, so 2019, which was the future back when I was writing this, and to have a woman now in her 30s whose best friend was this woman, Edie, whose best friend had died. But at the time it was ruled a suicide. And so there has to be some sort of hook that makes her begin to wonder what really happened that night and if it really was a suicide or if it was something else. And the problem is she doesn't have memories of that night because she was blackout, which was pretty common amongst the 23-year-olds, you know, at warehouse parties. And so once I had that idea, then I thought the next what if was what if sort of the more she digs and the more she uncovers, she begins to suspect herself and she has different reasons that she, you know, was fighting with this woman and having issues. And what if she, yeah, begins to suspect that she herself may have been involved and that's sort of her personal reason for needing to figure it out. And so, yeah, those were sort of the initial questions that began to take the form of this book. And it was just really fun to play with, you know, scuba diving in your own past and sort of themes of memory and the fallibility of it and technology and how 2009 was like right before we started documenting everything. So how would you go about checking the tapes from 2009? And you know, forgiveness and moving on and what if this really, you know, horrific and traumatizing thing had happened right on the cusp of adulthood and what would that do to sort of your development? So there was immediately a lot of really rich and fun fodder to till.
Well, it's also fun to kind of turn the protagonist role on its head when the protagonist might be the antagonist and the characters are not sure who they are and what role they're playing. That's a really fun thing to explore as a writer.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I love unreliable narrators, but I never wanted it to feel like the author was cheating because I get really frustrated in a book when it's like, it's a twist, but only because the author was lying to me. And so in this case, we have kind of an amateur detective who's investigating herself and she really wants to know the truth and she really wants to get answers. And to me, that makes for sort of a more interesting story than you, the reader, being lied to and later uncovering things. You're sort of uncovering, going down the rabbit hole and uncovering the truth along with her. So she's an incidental, unreliable narrator.
Well, I love the unreliable narrator as well. And but since Gillian Flynn did that to us in Gone Girl, mm-hmm. You as a writer have to be very careful because I think it's a crutch that too many people rely on that they can just throw a gotcha at the reader. And, you know, I was just kidding. This is not really what was, right. You know, going on. You can only do that so often. But what you did in The Lost Night, I think is brilliant because you get to play with that while being truthful to the character. And I think that's great.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, Gillian really made life harder for all future psychological yes. suspense and thriller yes, writers did. Because she, you know, complete master, hasn't written a book since then. But she set the bar for these books and readers expect something new and they are guessing about what the twists are going to be from page one, which means it's that much harder to have it both satisfying, you know, and well sort of well laid out and hinted at, but also surprising. She really messed things up for us.
yes, she did. So you finished that book. What was the process like for finding an agent and getting the book with the publisher?
Yeah, so it was about 2 years from the time that I started writing to the time that I felt like it was solid enough to start querying literary agents. And I, you know, did my research and I had a spreadsheet where I was keeping track of agents who were accepting queries and who were looking for books like mine. I looked up all the agents of my favorite authors in the same vein and I worked really hard on my query letter and, you know, had anyone who was willing to read it and give me notes and really try to get it perfect because that's your one shot at grabbing the attention of these people who get literally sometimes hundreds of queries a day. And when I felt like that was ready, I had a system and I sent out a certain number of queries a day and was very careful to follow their guidelines. And I was pretty lucky to get an offer within about 2 weeks. And then once I had an offer, I could go back to everyone else I'd queried who hadn't responded yet and let them know and see if they wanted to throw their hat in the ring. And so I was very lucky to end up with 3 offers of representation and talked to them all, did some more research, and ended up signing with the wonderful Alexandra Machinist at ICM. And so I did more revisions with her, and then she took the book out on submission to, you know, editors at different publishing houses that she thought would be good for it. And I was feeling pretty good at this point. You know, I'd gotten an agent quickly. I'd gotten several offers. I was like, this is going to go to auction. I was cocky. And I was wrong because it was roundly rejected. And everyone in the first round said no, except for 2 editors who said, you know, I can't buy it as is, but I'm willing to look at it again if she fixes all these problems. And it's called a revise and resubmit request. And it's awful because there's no guarantees. There's lots of cases of people doing a ton of revision, resubmitting it, and still getting a no. And there was the fact that there was 2 of them and their notes were a little bit different. And I said to my agent, like, how do you tell your authors to handle this? And she said, I don't know, because I've never had this happen before. So that's not a good thing to hear from someone who's been doing this for decades. But I dug deep and I really poured my heart and soul into another revision. And it was another huge, major changes, really sort of recast who this narrator was, who this protagonist was, changed some major plot points, really became yet another new book at this point. And resubmitted it, and thank the Lord, one of the editors very quickly made an offer on the revise and resubmit, and she continues to be my editor now. She's contracted with me through books 3 and 4 as well.
That's amazing. So the first book comes out, The Lost Night, and it recently released in paperback just a few months ago. During the publication process of that book, and you got all the edits done, it's going through publication, then launch. When did you start working on The Herd?
Oh, right in the middle of everything.
Of course.
So once I had turned in, I did more revisions with my editor. And then, you know, you go through a round with a copy editor, and then you go through several page proofs where you see what it'll look like laid out, and you mark it up with a red pen. So as that was going on, and once I was done working in a Word document on The Lost Night, it was summer 2018. And I knew I wanted to keep working with this editor, and my agent was all for it. So I started pitching ideas for the next book. And second books are hard, and my editor said no to the next 2 ideas that I sent her. And so I was really having to dig deep. And now in retrospect, I'm really glad she did, because what we settled on was the idea for The Herd, which is a thriller that's set in an exclusive all-female co-working space. And I'm glad she sort of pushed me to come up with something that, again, has that really strong and atmospheric and complex setting. Same way that sort of, you know, hipster Brooklyn is a interesting social milieu. But I sold that idea based on a treatment and a few sample chapters in September 2018. And after I'd sold it mid-September, she said, great, we wanted to come out a year after The Lost Night, which at that point hadn't come out yet. And so it'll be due January 15th, which was, let's see, four months out. And I was like, what now? and so I had to write that draft very, very quickly. I did not have the luxury of several years to work on it. But I think, you know, you learn something with every book. You know this. You get better every time you write a book, because you just, you know, the same way you'd get better at cross-stitch every time you took on a project. You do continue learning. And so came together much more quickly. And I worked on it over the winter of 2018 and early 2019. So right up until I turned it in right before the time that The Lost Knight hit shelves and I was in full promotion mode. So I was sort of a lot of spinning plates and juggling going on.
Of course. Now your creative process from book one and to book two completely changed. Book one, you played this what if game, had some time to kind of let that ruminate and grow, wrote on it for a couple of years. And this time, you know, the way you described it, where you're kind of pitching ideas back and forth with your editor. Mm-hmm. How did that change the writing process for you? Other than, you know, I'm under a deadline and,
right.
and this sort of thing. You know, there's nothing like writing that first book because no one knows you're doing it. No one's expecting right. anything. And now you're kind of under the gun with book two. But how did that process benefit you? Did you feel more creative in, you know, having sort of a collaborator to work with to bounce ideas off of, come up with kind of an overarching meta story that then you would fill in the details? Could you talk a little bit about the difference in those two creative processes?
Yeah. So I think a lot of authors have that relationship with their editor that you describe. And my editor, and I think this is, maybe she is this way with some of her authors, but with me, she is very hands-off. And so I actually approached it pretty similarly with this idea of like, what if there were a thriller set in an all-female co-working space? What would that look like? And I had a few ideas for the setup and, you know, what the main question would be. It would be about the CEO and founder of this, you know, exclusive, beautiful space vanishing the night of an important announcement. I had those sort of setup ideas and I pitched them to her and she liked them. And so when I say that I sold the book with a treatment, I purposely don't say outline because I didn't use an outline. I didn't know who done it or who the villain was or why Eleanor, the CEO, had vanished. And so the only way for me to learn that was to write it. And I remember my editor said to me right at the beginning as she was sort of signing on and cutting a check, she said, I don't want to know because I want to be surprised. But like, you know the end, right? Like, you know kind of who done it. And I was like, sure. Just lied to her face. Because I knew that for me and my process, the way for me to figure it out was to write the book. So I didn't, you know, I think some people do kind of get the entire story and shape approved by their editor and go back and forth to sort of work out kinks in the plot and pitch different directions. But for me, the way to figure it out is just to sit and hammer away on this book. And in that case, it was like 1200 words a day, every single day, no days off for 3 months. And then come out of that feral and look back at what I've created and sort of rework what needs reworking and trim what ended up not panning out.
So tell us a little bit about the setup of this book. So The Herd is this all-female workspace. What was the idea mm-hmm. behind that and how does that set up this great story that you've told?
Sure. So there's several all-female co-working spaces now across America and across the world. The Wing is one of the most famous ones, but there's also the Riveter and the Coven and the Luminary and the Assembly. They're really having a moment, you know, like co-working spaces had a moment and then the next one was these all-female spaces. And they're really set up and designed to be sort of this feminist utopia. They're all about mentorship and empowerment, and they're really beautiful and have all of these, you know, wonderful perks. There's amazing products in the bathroom and there's amazing speakers at night and the whole thing is just very Instagram perfect. And I noticed, I'm not a member of one, but I've been a guest at several. And I noticed that when I would go to these places, even though their whole stated goal is that they're, you know, away from the male gaze, when I went, I would pay attention to my outfit. I would think about my hair and makeup. When I was there, I was trying to sort of be charming and really fit in with all of these spectacular women who were members of this space. And I thought that was just sort of an interesting tension of, right. You know, the space is inclusive, but necessarily exclusive. And the space is
opposite effect of what it was touted as.
Yeah. And that's not to malign them. Certainly that says more about me and internalized misogyny than anything else. But I thought it would be really interesting to take this space that looks so perfect on the outside and to sort of dig into what might be the dark and ugly underbelly as kind of a metaphor for, you know, professional women and high-achieving women and the incredibly sky-high standards that professional women face, where they need to be, you know, always coiffed. They need to be... you know, strategic and great leaders, but also very warm and very approachable. And they need to be, you know, confident, but not arrogant. They have to also be humble and they have to be, you know, risk-taking, but always measured. And just all of these tight ropes that professional women are walking on while sort of presenting this Instagram perfect facade. And so I had a lot of fun playing with that as a theme of sort of, again, what if questions. What if women in this beautiful space were sort of forced into a crucible where their perfect veneers would begin to crack? And I had a lot of fun playing with that.
Yeah, and hilarity ensues from there. Tell us about the character of Eleanor.
So Eleanor was actually one of the hardest characters for me to pin down. The book is told from dual narrators, from the perspective of Eleanor's two close friends, who are also sisters. And one of them is the PR director for the Herd, and she went to Harvard with Eleanor. And she's sort of very buttoned up and adult, and she's been a part of the Herd since day one. Oh, and I should add the Herd, the slogan is the Herd with the H-E-R always in purple. And because it's a space that's all for her, and that still makes me laugh. And then the other narrator, and we alternate back and forth, is Hannah's younger sister, Katie, who just moved back from a stint of writing, you know, caring for her sick mother and working on a book in the Midwest. And she's, also friends with Eleanor for a long time, and she's really hoping to become a member of the Herd. And so you sort of see Eleanor, as a reader, you see Eleanor through the lens of these two sisters who have secrets of their own and have different relationships with Eleanor. You know, in a way that I think is true of all humans, they believe that they alone sort of know the real Eleanor and know the true Eleanor, the way that I think we all do with everyone we know. And in truth, every person is, of course, very multifaceted. But Eleanor was a really fun character to try to write because she is sort of the living embodiment of that Herd ideal. She is feminist and smart and above reproach, and she makes everything look effortless, and she's just good at everything. Her home is impeccably decorated. Her hair always looks perfect. She always has the right thing to say. She's great on camera, all that stuff that, you know, you would hate her if she wasn't so great, and so you love her. And I feel like those people are sort of the ones who seem to have it the easiest, but actually are under the water. Their little duck legs are sort of paddling the hardest, paddling the fastest. And so it was really fun to start with what we see on the outside and then peel back the layers, to mix metaphors, and get into what would lead a woman to, you know, feel a need to be so professionally successful and perfect seeming.
And then Eleanor disappears. Yes. And then we're left with all these questions. What would she run? Did something happen to her? Is there foul play at work here? What if questions? What if this highly successful woman just disappeared? How would we react? and we get a great story that unfolds from there. After writing the book, a lot of times you look back and you will notice themes that kind of permeate through the story that a lot of times the writer didn't even intend.
Sure.
But things just kind of come out. At the end of writing this, did you notice things that came out during the story and during the writing of this that maybe surprised you?
Sure. So a lot of things about this, you know, I guess because I work without an outline and I have no idea what I'm doing while I'm actually writing it, I get to the end and I kind of realize, oh, you know, I mentioned before the herd itself as a space is sort of a metaphor for these women who have to look Instagram perfect on the outside. And I didn't even really notice that till I was writing it, to give one of many examples. Or the herd as an idea and a concept ends up coming up later, talking about herds of deer, for example, sticking together for protection and predators, and you know, a theme sort of surprising me by working its way in later. All of the twists surprise me because I don't see them coming either, and I'm shocked when characters say or do things that totally change what I thought was going on. And another theme that came up that ended up being interesting, the prologue to the book describes in great detail a body freezing sort of cell by cell. And this book takes place in winter and it's cold. And this sort of theme came up about preservation and how something frozen in theory could last forever. You can, you know, eat a chunk of meat that's been in a freezer consistently for 100 years. And so self-preservation comes up in these different ways through, you know, beauty product, anti-aging beauty products get a mention, and sort of preserving the physical self. And then also in a less literal sense, preservation, the length that we'll go to in order to protect ourselves and protect our secrets. So yeah, there's always, it's amazing looking back. And then someone will ask a question and I'll be like, I truly never thought about that, but interesting. Like, readers bring this totally new perspective to it and analyze things that I never thought about. So that's always really fun.
The new book is called The Herd. It's available everywhere now. There are links to it in the show notes of this episode. Also, The Lost Night. Don't forget The Lost Night. We'll put a link to that as well. Andrea, if people are just learning about you and want to dig in to all the great stuff you do, is there a place they can connect with you online?
Yeah, absolutely. So my website is AndreaBartz.com, and I've got virtual events on there, and you can read more and about my books, and you can see some of my freelance writing, which I still do. And I am on Twitter and Instagram at AndyBartz, AndiBartz. I'm pretty active on both of those and love hearing from people. And over on Facebook, my author page is /AndreaBartzAuthor. And I would love to hear from people.
We'll put links to all that in the show notes so that people can connect with you. Andrea, this has been so much fun talking. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was super fun.
Authors, I have a fantastic new service to tell you about. It's called PubSite. PubSite is a service to help you build your very own website, your home on the web, where you can promote your work and give your fans a place to connect with you. PubSite is a website platform that allows every author, regardless of budget, to have a great-looking professional website. Developed by the book marketing professionals at FSB Associates, PubSite is the new easy-to-use DIY website builder developed specifically for books and authors. Whether you're an author of one book or 20, or a small publisher, PubSite allows you to build, design, and most importantly, update your website pain-free. No need to be dependent on a designer or webmaster to make a small but costly change to your website. Save the money and do it yourself. PubSite is the best platform for authors because it's a book-centric platform. PubSite was built just for authors and small publishers. Every design, feature, and layout is book-centric. They have customized designs for you to use. It's easy to build. No coding or HTML is necessary to create a stunning, professional-looking website with all the features you want. get a custom domain name, yourname.com. It's simple to update. You can add all of your books, add a blog and a book tour, sell from any retailer, manage your email list and social media, and even do e-commerce. Build your website with a 14-day free trial, then pay just $19.99 per month, which includes hosting. And we offer packages starting at $499 to set up the website for you. Pub-site.com, the place to help authors find their home on the web.